All right, hello everybody. Merry Christmas. Time for some 49ers analysis. Home after that game against Miami. And we'll start with simple truths. Brock Purdy played well. That's simple truth number one. Guess who else played well? This guy right here. That is Deebo Samuel. Article up on the San Francisco Standard. Samuel, Kittle, and Purdy delivered. But the 49ers supporting cast in a tremendously undisciplined effort from the supporting cast did not. This is one of those football games, and I'll preface this by saying that NFL football, football in general, it's organized chaos, right? It can be tough to parse a game and who's most responsible for a loss, who performed well, even defeat, even in wins, obviously. There's a lot of debate about who contributed how much, who deserves credit. This one wasn't that all too hard to figure out. The 49ers committed 11 penalties for 90 yards, and the 49ers also missed a field goal. They also didn't defend the run well. On the offensive side of the ball, their star players delivered, but their offensive line, which was in tatters, didn't. I think that's a fairly simple, concise explanation of what happened, and I think it's a very, very valid one. But obviously, even something that is common sense, as we know because we have tracked how the football discourse works, especially the 49ers discourse works, it's particularly toxic. That is something that just is too hard to grasp for a lot of people. And I think that we've gone off the rails already years ago in terms of post-game analysis and then day-after analysis. And that's why I always just try to bring it back to center. And that's what we can do today. Anyway, the article is up on the San Francisco Standard grading the 49ers, talking about Samuel, Kittle, and Purdy. We can talk about Purdy first, and then we could talk about Purdy a little bit later. But here's the efficiency from the game yesterday. Purdy actually outplayed Tua Tagovailoa. Was a little bit more efficient than Tua. As you could see, the QBR, expected QBR for the game at 60. 50 is about average. It had Tua at a little bit below average in this football game. I thought Tua, though, did make some nice throws in the football game. I don't think he was bad by any stretch. But I think that Brock Purdy was a little bit better, especially given the fact that he was running for his life for the majority of this game. There are some performance splits that you should see here. Brock Purdy, when he was kept clean in the pocket, was 22 of 29 for 271 yards. That's really good. 9.3 yards per attempt, a couple of touchdowns. And the average time from snap to release was a very quick 2.05 seconds. Let me give you some perspective here. Tua, yesterday on all of his throws, the average snap to release was the quickest in the NFL at 2.45 seconds. So Tua was getting the ball out very quickly. 49ers were only able to notch six pressures against him because of that. Purdy, when he wasn't pressured, was getting the ball out about 0.4 of a second faster on average than Tua Tagovailoa was getting out, and that was the league's quickest rate. So Purdy kept clean was exactly what you want to see out of a quick strike offense, and I think the 49ers were trying to run that against the Miami Dolphins. But as soon as Miami got pressure on him, and they got a lot of pressure on him, they generated 16 pressures against the 49ers. It went from 9.3 yards per attempt to 3.8 yards per attempt. 4-11, 42 yards, no touchdowns. The interception that obviously wasn't Purdy's fault. That was Calais Campbell coming in off the stunt on the inside. And the time to throw right here is the biggest indicator of what happened on the field, and it definitely matches the tape. Nearly 4 seconds average snap to release, which means that Purdy was running for his life in this game. There were multiple instances where there was pressure up the A-gap, and Purdy had to bail to his left. After he bailed, one time he bails to his left, and they're also blitzing the corner. Jalen Ramsey is coming in on the blitz for Miami, and Purdy has to juke Jalen Ramsey, which is impressive. A blitzing cornerback, you know, normally the quarterback's dead to rights in those situations. He's running from pressure up the A-gap from a defensive lineman. Then he has to blitz a much more agile, dodge a much more agile corner. And that's exactly what Brock Purdy did. He reset, he threw maybe a little bit too high to Deebo Samuel, and it was incomplete. But just the escape was a Houdini act. for Brock Purdy. So you see it reflected here in the statistics for Purdy and the 49ers. Three point nine two seconds on average from snap to release is a long time, which means that he was running for his life. Anyway, when you see these splits, the first thing you need to ask yourself is, how did the pressure come? If the pressure came via blitz and Brock Purdy was this inefficient under pressure, you'd immediately say, okay, there might be something wrong with how the quarterback played yesterday. But so much of this pressure came from four-man rushes from the Miami Dolphins. And that is the big problem that the 49ers faced. And I wrote about it yesterday on the San Francisco Standard. The 49ers just need to do more to protect Brock Purdy. That is priority number one. He is their future at the quarterback position. They're going to pay him a lot of money, whether you like it or not, because that is the right decision to make based on his body of work. And now the 49ers need to protect their investment. And yesterday's game underscored how important it is to protect when the opponent is not blitzing. Because a four-man rush over the longer course of NFL history that can get home is undefeated. It has beaten Tom Brady in Super Bowls. I still remember the 2007 season when the Patriots were 18-0. They entered that Super Bowl against the NASCAR package New York Giants, and the front four of the Giants got pressure without blitzing, and they held, what was it, a 14-point output, I think, for the New England Patriots in that game. They held Tom Brady to two touchdowns, and the Patriots finished 18-1. A four-man rush that can deliver pressure has derailed Joe Montana. It's derailed Steve Young. It's derailed Patrick Mahomes. Remember Super Bowl 55 against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers? Shaq Barrett coming hard off the edge. Well, that was a game where four men got pressure against the depleted Kansas City offensive line, and even Mahomes couldn't deliver. If you can generate pressure with four, you do not have the holes on the back end that can be exploited when you have to generate pressure with a blitz. Anytime you bring an extra defender, so a fifth pass rusher or a sixth pass rusher, you're taken away from the coverage. Instead of seven in coverage, you only have six, or you know, if you rush six, you're only going to have five on a zero type of blitz. So there's going to be inherently a vulnerability in the back end that a quarterback, especially a good quarterback, can exploit. And Brock Purdy has been one of the best QBs against the blitz over the course of his entire NFL career now, and he still isn't even 25 years old. But if a defense can bring pressure with just four, as Miami did frequently yesterday, the quarterback is not going to win in the long run. No quarterback will win. No quarterback in NFL history will be able to deliver in the long run, because the holes on the back end just are not there to exploit. And if the rush is getting home quickly with four, then there's nowhere to go for the quarterback. As you saw on the interception, Calais Campbell ran the stunt there inside. 49ers didn't pick it up at all. Purdy was trying to make a layered throw over the middle of the field, and he got hit before he could cleanly release the football. End of story. There are some people going on the internet right now saying, oh, he should have thrown to Patrick Taylor Jr. Okay, the fifth read on the play. How do you expect the quarterback to work down in his progression to the fifth read when you have a defensive tackle who's one of the four pass rushers, not even blitzing, pressuring him untouched up the A-gap? The math doesn't math. It took Calais Campbell less than 2.5 seconds to get to Brock Purdy. You're not making it to your fifth read. Patrick Taylor Jr., who had already dropped the pass in this game, in under 2.5 seconds. It's just not going to happen. So let's take a look at these numbers. Offensively, the 49ers in the game yesterday, this is where the big hole was. Green is good. purple is bad. You want to be in the green in all of these efficiency categories. They're fine overall, their offensive plays, decently efficient offense. They're fine over their passing plays, a high success rate. 53% is a good success rate for passing plays. By the way, the 49ers are on the left side here. Just want to make sure that you could see. The Dolphins are on the right side. 49ers are on the left side of this graphic. The 49ers, though, on early down rushing plays, I'm zooming in. Here they are in the purple. They did not execute the early down run game nearly as efficiently as Miami did. Look at the early down run game for the Dolphins. Positive EPA, positive success rate, first down percentage, 24% of Miami's early down runs turned into first downs. For the 49ers, negative expected points added, 31% success rate, that's obviously low, and only 8% of their first down runs turned into first downs or moved the chains. So what happened here is that the 49ers, with their inability to run the ball on early downs, really set themselves up for hell against the four-man pass rush on second and third downs, especially given the fact that that offensive line was depleted. By the end of the game, you didn't have Jalen Moore, who's your backup tackle, so you're going to Spencer Burford, who hadn't played tackle since he was in college at San Antonio at left tackle, and you had to go with Nick Zakel for his first meaningful career action at left guard after Aaron Banks went down. So an offensive line that was already struggling to pick up the complexities of what Miami was running with those stunts. Calais Campbell inside, he's so good at that. We know all about him and his 16-year career. The line was already struggling against the nuances and the exotic looks that Miami was bringing. On top of that, they didn't establish a run game, so they were, you know, their backs were put up against the wall to an even greater extent, and then they started dropping like flies with injuries. So you're playing with a completely depleted line against an exotic pass rush without a run game. The fact that Brock Purdy threw for over 300 yards should probably tell you that the 49ers do need to reward him handsomely this offseason. And it's happened so many times over the course of this season that the 49ers offensive system has just generally been broken. It's been a broken product around Brock Purdy, but he has still willed the 49ers to some kind of productivity. The problem is that in a team sport, ultimately you need everybody to be carrying their weight, and the 49ers haven't done that. If you want to look at something that is a positive development schematically for the 49ers, I think we did see this yesterday. The 49ers' screen pass rate continued to increase. They ran 8 screens yesterday, completed all 8 of them for 103 yards at nearly 13 yards per attempt. Remember, over weeks 1 through 11, the 49ers had the lowest screen pass rate in the NFL. I still don't know what Kyle Shanahan was doing over those first 11 weeks. And we hammered it home on the channel. We were talking about the need to throw more screens, offset some of these extremely aggressive pass rushes, take advantage of the fact that you've got guys who are good at yards after the catch, and set the table with that. Also set the table for the offensive linemen to get downfield and show some of their athleticism. Well, the torturous early season stretch where the 49ers seemed allergic to screen passes is now over. Over the past 4 games, they've run the third most screens in football, and especially to George Kittle and Deebo Samuel. That was very productive yesterday. I will say that it is of no coincidence that Deebo Samuel enjoyed a resurgence during a game that saw the 49ers throw 8 screen passes. As I've been saying all year, call what Deebo's good at, and Deebo is going to look better. Now, I think the Deebo struggles throughout the course of this year have been multi-layered. It's a complicated situation. I could go through some of the pillars that I think have led to those struggles. He was coming off of a great start to the season between training camp and weeks 1 and 2, over 100 receiving yards in week 2 at Minnesota when he hurt his oblique. Oblique injuries, especially for a player as physical as Deebo Samuel, can linger. They could limit the player. They could be tough to get over, and I think we might have seen that happen. On top of that, following the Week 7 game against Kansas City, Deebo Samuel was hospitalized with pneumonia. So it really was a season of hell for him. And even if he is 100% healthy now and that oblique is feeling great, you could see that there could be some potential downstream effects as far as confidence goes, mojo goes, from that early season rash of bad luck, the oblique injury, and then pneumonia. But B, I think the 49ers also have just not been running the offensive structure that they had in years prior that had helped make Deebo Samuel and George Kittle and essentially all their players, all their offensive weapons so successful. I mean, up until very recently, they were dead last in yak. Up until week 11, they were dead last in the amount of screen passes they had attempted. Up until really recently, Brock Purdy had the highest time to throw average in the entire NFL. This was very unlike the 49ers offense of years past. I do think that there are signs that Kyle Shanahan has counter-adjusted. He had previously blamed the lack of screen passes on the fact that defenses were ready for them. Well, the Dolphins didn't look too ready for the screen passes that the 49ers ran yesterday. And they, Shanahan also called that play 8 times, which is a lot, the most in a single game for the 49ers this season. So if you're looking for Shanahan to reinvent himself, to be able to counter adjust, to be a better version of a play caller in 2025 than what he was here in 2024, this should be a big, big indicator of optimism for you. The fact that the 49ers ran so many screen passes. At the end of the day, though, and I talk about this a lot in the grades, the fact that the 49ers were on their 5th-string running back in Patrick Taylor Jr. causes massive problems across the offense. Toss out the pass protection issues from the offensive line and just look at what a good, trusted running back does for this football team. Christian McCaffrey's a great one. He's a perfect example of this. It's not just a running thing, although running is a big part of this. The 49ers need a pass outlet from the running back position, especially on 2nd and 3rd downs. There was a play where Purdy went through his progressions correctly, was pressured very quickly. So he found Patrick Taylor to the flat. I thought, that was Christian McCaffrey. Would have had a good chance of picking up a 1st down. He usually shakes at least one defender. Patrick Taylor Jr. shook nobody, and he was tackled past the line of scrimmage, but behind the line to gain, and the 49ers punted. Earlier, there were 2 consecutive plays, one on which Taylor dropped the ball, and it almost turned into a big man interception, big man without his helmet on the play, but the ball did hit the ground. And a 2nd one where Taylor not only ran to the wrong side of Brock Purdy on what I thought should have been a play action fake, but also released incorrectly into the passing field of play. And Brock Purdy almost threw an interception because he threw to where Patrick Taylor Jr. should have been, but Taylor wasn't there. And so I asked Taylor about that play in the locker room, and the answer is here in 49ers grades up on the San Francisco Standard. This was his answer to me. He said, "I just didn't get out clean. I tripped getting out. That was the right read for Brock. It was just on me." So here's a great example of a situation where everybody on the internet who doesn't know what they're talking about starts piling on Brock Purdy. He's like, "Oh, how can he make such an ugly pass to Patrick Taylor Jr.?" Well, it was actually on the running back. The running back ran the wrong route. The running back kind of tripped getting out of the backfield, wasn't in the right place. And Purdy, when you're throwing to a running back in that situation, it's an outlet throw. It's happening when you're under duress. You've gone through your other reads, and now you're under duress, and you've got to get that check down off. And so you're normally thrown to a spot. You're normally throwing on feel. That running back, you trust him to be at a certain spot. Christian McCaffrey's always at the spot that Brock Purdy needs him to be at, and that outlet allows the 49ers to defeat a lot of pressure. That's why I said forget the pressure allowed by the offensive line, because sometimes that running back outlet can allow the quarterback to beat the pressure that the offensive line allows. But as we saw in this game yesterday, the 49ers down to their 5th-string running back just aren't in position to beat pressure through the standard outlet route that I think they had built into their offense because Christian McCaffrey was such an integral part of it. Patrick Taylor Jr. just isn't the same player, obviously, as McCaffrey, but I don't think he's the same player as Elijah Mitchell. I don't think he's the same player as Jordan Mason. I don't think he's the same player as Isaac Grendo. You run into issues like this when so many injuries happen, and we saw that happen yesterday. Now, again, I just laugh when you see some of these ideas from people saying, oh, he should have hit Taylor on the interception play underneath. As if those people, first off, I mean, there's several ways to just completely discredit that thought. Did you see Taylor try to catch the ball early in the game? Did you see Taylor run the wrong route and be in poor position on the play right after that early in the game? What makes you think that Brock Purdy is going to have some kind of insane rapport with Patrick Taylor late in the game with everything on the line in the fourth quarter as his fifth read? What makes you think that Purdy's going to skip over the entire structure of the offense to go to a guy with whom he obviously hasn't established any rapport, to a fifth string running back? It's just not going to happen. That's not how football works. That's not how the 49ers offense works. And it only works that way in the minds of people who play too many video games, who are looking at a screenshot and say, oh, he should have thrown there because the throw to where, you know, the ball actually went didn't work out. And that's such an overly simplistic way of looking at things. To that last play, well, it wasn't the last play, but it was the last play of that drive. It was the penultimate drive for the 49ers, and it was essentially the play that doomed them. I talked in the locker room to Dominic Pooney, who was at right guard on that play when Calais Campbell initially started working against right guard, but then scraped over, and it was the stunt move, right? Just went unblocked by Jake Brendel. Yes, it is an exotic move. It is a complex move, but the Dolphins were running a ton of those exotic games up front. It is one the 49ers absolutely must pick up. That being said, Campbell deserves a lot of credit because if you watch the tape, he hides for a second. There's a lot of confusion there. He hides by Miami's other defensive tackle for, I would say, 0.1, 0.2 seconds. I mean, it's a very, very short period of time, but it's just enough hesitation for Campbell to hide, Jake Brendel not to see him there for that split second because there's another lineman right in front of him as they're crisscrossing. And then Campbell turns on the afterburners, takes two steps. He's by Brendel, wasn't quick enough on the play to pick him up, and he just decks Brock Purdy. That's pressure from a four-man rush. And again, pressure that gets home from four is undefeated in NFL history. It has beaten all the great quarterbacks. And in this case, it beat Brock Purdy, and it beat the 49ers at the very end of the game. And that wasn't the only play that they failed to pick up, but it was definitely the most famous play of that game that they didn't pick up because it led directly to the interception. As far as the throw goes, like the decision on the throw, it was the right one from Purdy. He has his receiver open on the second level. Deebo Samuel was running the clear out pattern. And because of the clear out went well, that took one of the DBs further downfield. It set up a difficult but very manageable throw for Brock Purdy. Had the pocket been clean over the first level of defense in front of the back level of the defense. Unfortunately for Purdy, he got hit as he tried to throw it, so it didn't work out. The way that the 49ers operate this offense, precision, timing, you name it, especially this year without Brandon Ayuk available, he's the big space guy on offense, right? He's going to create space. So does Christian McCaffrey. Neither of those two guys played in this game yesterday. So the way that the 49ers operate this offense is absolutely reliant on there being some semblance of a clean pocket for Brock Purdy. At some level, you can generate plays and generate some efficiency if Purdy's running around, and he's done a lot of that this year. But at the fundamental core base of this offense, you do have to block those four up front for at least 2.5 seconds. They can't get home as quickly as they did. There were multiple instances of A-gap pressure yesterday that just were unacceptable for the 49ers. And that's why I wrote about this right after the game. The 49ers have to be better equipped next season to deal with a strong four-man pass rush. And I understand that injuries have made the line worse as this season has gone along, but so has regression from two spots in particular, from Brendel at center and from Aaron Banks at left guard. Banks is going to be a free agent. He was hurt yesterday with what's likely the MCL. Jake Brendel is still under contract, but I keep on thinking back to 2018 when the 49ers signed Weston Richburg, a name brand center who ended up being a really good player for them, but unfortunately got hurt in 2019. And I think back to 2021 when they signed Alex Mack, another name brand center who was at the tail end of his career, but was also a really good player for them and a huge reason why they turned it around from 6-10 in 2020 to the NFC Championship game in 2021. Shanahan has always wanted that veteran center. After Mack retired in early 22, the 49ers went to Jake Brendel, who, to his credit, played well in 2022, pass protected well in 22. I think it was also solid in 23, but there have been a lot of issues at that spot. I don't know if it's connected to the knee tendonitis over the offseason, but the 49ers have needed better pass protection from the center position multiple times this season. They've needed some better run blocking from the center position at critical junctures this season. And I always think back to how important getting a name brand center has been for Kyle Shanahan over the course of his 49ers tenure. It's happened with two signings, Richburg and Mack. Unfortunately, one saw his career derailed due to injury and the other one just retired after the 2021 season. So I am very curious to see what the 49ers do about the center position this offseason. Defensively, this was a problem for San Francisco. They have forced only one turnover over the past five games. So we can look all day long at the personal fouls, and those were bad yesterday. Jordan Elliott had one. Talanoa Hufanga had one. Deommodore Lenore had one. Hey, 11 penalties, 90 yards, 3 for 45, though. So half of that penalty yardage came from unnecessary roughness, personal fouls that the 49ers just should not commit. And I would dare to say that had they not committed any of those personal fouls, they probably win this game. They've got at least they've got a better shot at it, that's for sure. I mean, all the penalties cumulatively, those definitely sunk the 49ers. If you look at Ricky Pearsall's illegal formation penalties, especially the second one that nullified the third down conversion from Brock Purdy to Deebo Samuel, that one ended up probably wiping 7 points off the board for the 49ers in a game that they trailed by five late with the game in the balance, right? So I think that the totality of the penalties, if you look at the formation penalties plus the personal foul penalties on defense, those obviously sunk the 49ers. That's why I talk about the undisciplined football derailing the really good stuff that Brock Purdy, Deebo Samuel, and George Kittle did. But I think just the personal foul penalties alone might have been enough to sink the 49ers. Those extended drives, those overexposed the defense. We saw fatigue when Achane delivered the 50-yard dagger at the end. We saw fatigue play a factor for the defense. And they also just hurt field position. And when the offense is struggling in pass protection, when the offense doesn't have its full load of firepower with guys like Ayuk and Christian McCaffrey done for this season, you need every single yard you can get. You need to set your offense up. And the 49ers, with the penalties they suffered yesterday on the defensive side of the ball, just did not position themselves appropriately. Now, that being said, this defense, and Fred Warner talked about it at halftime. He said, told his teammates, we need to force a takeaway. Because without a takeaway, we're not winning this game. That's what Warner said in the locker room at halftime. And again, the 49ers defense came up short. Is some of this on Nick Sorensen? I mean, yes, we talked about it. First-year coordinator needs to improve for the 49ers, especially as he moves from year one to year two. And I think we have seen some strides from Nick Sorensen. The 49ers were coming off their best two-game defensive stretch of the season against the Chicago Bears and then the Los Angeles Rams. But the most dominant play, and I'd venture to say the only time the 49ers have delivered dominant play on the defensive side of the ball this season, has come when Dre Greenlaw and Talanoa Hufanga have both been simultaneously available to play in the game, both simultaneously healthy and in the game. And the window for that has obviously been exceptionally small. Hufanga came back against the Bears. Greenlaw came back a few days later against the Rams. They got about a half together against the Rams. And remember how they just overpowered Matthew Stafford and the Rams over the course of that first half. But even as Greenlaw and Hufanga really completed the 49ers defensive puzzle against the Rams over the course of that first half, the 49ers dropped two surefire, or should have been surefire, Matthew Stafford interceptions. And that's led to the ugly statistic at the bottom of your screen. One turnover in five games. This is a 49ers team that led the NFL in interceptions over 2022 and 2023. And here they're sitting with one turnover in five games. And I think that was Caleb Williams throwing the ball backwards. So that really wasn't even a forced turnover against the Chicago Bears. There was pressure on the play, I get it, but it was a screw up more on Caleb Williams' part than the 49ers preying on a pass on the back end. So I really think that Sorensen is a first-year coordinator who's not good enough at that job, at least yet, to overcome a stable that is significantly compromised, a stable of talent on the defensive side that's significantly compromised. And Dre Greenlaw has proven to be much more important to the 49ers defense than a lot of people on the outside approximated him to be. So Sorensen working without Greenlaw for the vast majority of this season and working with a lot of trouble at linebacker. We talk about Devondre Campbell walking out on the team, but dealing with that, and you know, D Winters, again, he exited the game yesterday with a chest injury. All of these things working against the 49ers on defense have truly exposed the coaching limitations that San Francisco has defensively. And there was just too many open lanes in the run game yesterday, 166 yards for the Dolphins. And if it weren't for a couple drops from Tyreek Hill, one clear drop from Tyreek Hill early in the game, the passing allowance would have been even greater from the 49ers secondary. Ultimately, though, I think they recognized with the speed that Miami had offensively, with the accuracy that Tua Tagovailoa throws with, they recognized that Miami would pick up some yardage in this game. They're not denying that. They didn't think this was going to be some kind of airtight effort, but the 49ers wanted to push the Dolphins into third down situations where they could tee off on Tua Tagovailoa and force some mistakes because he can be a little bit skittish in the pocket. And they never did get into position to force those mistakes. Again, even though they had some third down stops, and you know, even though some of those third down stops came on incompletions downfield from Tagovailoa to players like Tyreek Hill, River Craycraft, the former 49ers, the target on one of them, 49ers were never in position to intercept the pass. They were never undercutting a route. They never flummoxed Tagovailoa enough to create a near interception opportunity. And it was just more of the same. It was only one forced turnover over the past five games. I would venture to say that the 49ers defensive line is still actually strength of this team. I wrote about it this week. That is a burgeoning part of this defense. But the hard, cold reality for the 49ers is that without Dre Greenlaw fitting the run game, doing what he does in coverage to support the defensive line, and without Charvarius Ward playing at his all-pro level, and with some instability at safety, we saw Malik Mustafa come back, so it was only three or four snaps for Jair Brown. Obviously, Hufanga is still fully working his way back into the mix. With that instability in the back seven, fueled by some of these injuries this season, the 49ers just haven't been the same complete defense that they've been in years past, and I think that the lack of takeaways really, really illustrates that. So that's something that they absolutely have to find the secret mix with and repair over the course of this offseason. So anyway, that's the look through the game. I've got a couple other notes here. I got hot water with lemon. Helps the throat as I sit here talking for 40 minutes about the 49ers. A couple other notes, though. George Kittle now has 967 receiving yards on the season. So with just 33 more over the course of the final two games, George Kittle can hit the 1,000 yard mark for the second straight time and for the fourth time in his career. So that means that Kittle, who is on his way to the Hall of Fame, whenever the time comes for that, is, I mean, when you watch him play, it really is something that I think people should appreciate. Again, you're watching a walking first ballot Hall of Famer at this point. But to deliver 1,000 yards from any position, at receiver, it's impressive. To be able to deliver 1,000 yards, though, from tight end, especially some of the limitations, given some of the limitations the 49ers have faced offensively this year without Brandon Ayuk, their traditional X wide receiver, without Christian McCaffrey there. So Kittle's working against limited space. For him to do what he's done over the course of his entire career, but this season specifically, I think has been really, really impressive. And when he does cross that 1,000 yard threshold, it's going to be a true accomplishment for George Kittle this year. Debo Samuel scored his first touchdown since that long one against Seattle in week 6. And Debo had 93 yards after the catch in this game. Back against Seattle in week 6, he had 73 yards after the catch. That was his previous season high. But if you remember that long touchdown, that fed most of his yak in that game. That was 40 plus yards after the catch for Debo Samuel against the Seattle Seahawks. So the yak in that game was much, much easier to come by than it was in this one when he had to just plow over defenders time and time again. So this was a vintage Debo Samuel game, and I think it's going to give people a lot to think about as they try to form their 49ers rosters for the 2025 season when this offseason does begin. We're going to take a look at that 49ers 90-man roster right now to put all of this in context. But there had been obviously a lot of noise, especially after the Debo Samuel drop against the Rams, a lot of noise about the 49ers potentially moving on from Debo Samuel after this season. I think it's obviously possible, but when you see what he's capable of and when you consider the fact that he's been through a lot of adversity, like so many of his teammates this season, there clearly still is something left in the tank for Debo Samuel. And if the 49ers feel that his versatility and his ability to bowl over defenders is still something that can fuel this offense, the performances like the one that we saw yesterday, they're going to be very, very interested and making sure that he sticks around through at least the entirety of his contract. Here's what the roster looks like entering next season as far as guys who are under contract. Green means that a player is already under contract for the 2020. Samuel is under contract. So is Jennings, so is Pearsall, so is Cowing, so is Brandon Ayuk. If the 49ers want, they could essentially stand pat and have an entire game day receiving core ready to go with who's already under contract, except for the not so tiny asterisk of Brandon Ayuk, who's coming off of a severe knee injury. So you have to remember everything that the 49ers do in building this team for 2025 on the offensive side of the ball has to consider the possibility, maybe even the probability, that Brandon Ayuk is not back or at least not himself for week 1. So that's why Debo Samuel is not going to be just so easy to discard for the 49ers over the course of this offseason. And I think the performance yesterday should have reminded some people why. And a lot of people are saying, well, why didn't this come sooner? Well, I think that these guys, this is not a video game. These guys are human beings. These guys play through injuries. You know, well, a lot of people who sit there on their couch trying to talk about, you know, oh, this guy is not playing as well this year. He's not putting in as much effort. He's lost it. You don't realize that playing through an oblique injury can be painful. It can be impossible sometimes to put up the numbers that you had in previous seasons. And I think that there's just way too much casual analysis that doesn't look at Debo's season deeply enough. So keep that in mind as you pay attention to how the 49ers make their moves at the receiver position. On top of all this, the running back position is going to be extremely important to keep healthier next season than it has been this season, because we should look at the depth chart in the context of how the 49ers are operating at running back. You don't even see Christian McCaffrey up there anymore because he's on injured reserve. Elijah Mitchell on IR. Mitchell's contract, by the way, will toll. So he's going to be under contract for next season since he didn't play at all this season. Previously, his rookie contract had been expected to end after 2024, but Mitchell might be a depth opportunity for the 49ers in 2025. You don't see Jordan Mason on here because he's on IR. Obviously, you see Garendo, but he was hurt, so they're going to want him to be part of this. This is the one position where the 49ers are just very, very excited to get back to health. I think that even if you don't retain Jordan Mason in restricted free agency, a McCaffrey-Garendo 1-2 punch is very, very exciting if both of those guys are healthy entering 2025. And I think there's a very good chance of that happening. Now, I was a little bit disappointed just personally that we didn't get to see Israel Abanaconda yesterday for the 49ers. Abanaconda came off of waivers. 49ers claimed him from the Jets. I thought that, okay, without Isaac Garendo, this might be the opportunity for Abanaconda to see some reps for the 49ers. But obviously, that was not in the cards. They could be worried about his pass protecting ability. Does he have, you know, all the route running down? We saw that there were issues with Patrick Taylor Jr. in that regard yesterday. So maybe Abanaconda is even further behind Taylor in that regard, and they don't want to expose him too early. But at some point this season, and there are only two games left, it would be good for the 49ers to see what they have on a game day from Israel Abanaconda so they can better plan for 2025. He's under contract through 2025. And when the 49ers do get as desperate as they have been at running back, it is much easier to appreciate how important the position is within the larger structure of the offense, since it contributes not only in the run game, but also in that check down passing game that is so, so important. And when you have McCaffrey, it's not just about the check downs with him. It's also about the space that he creates with the gravity that he generates. And the 49ers obviously were not getting that yesterday from Patrick Taylor Jr. All right, where do we finish here? Are we going to go to Q&A? I think we should go to Q&A. Let's do it. See what Mike's not saying anything in the WhatsApp. So we can go to 49ers Q&A. Talked about defense. You know, one of the personal fouls was on Jordan Elliott yesterday. That was a bad one. Kind of dove down after the ball carrier had been tackled. But Elliott also made a couple nice run stops. And I have to go back to the point that I made last week, where the defensive line, the 49ers signed so many of these free agents over the course of the 2024 offseason to two-year deals. Jordan Elliott, Leonard Floyd, Yetur Gross-Matos, all these guys on two-year deals. They had seen a blossoming over the two games entering this one that I think really illustrated the multi-year plan for the defensive line. And I still think we saw more of that yesterday, but it was a lot harder to identify because Tua was getting the ball out in 2.45 seconds. My roundabout point here about Jordan Elliott is he had a couple of monstrous run stops yesterday. That's great. That's what they need him for. He's not much of a pass rusher, but he also had the personal foul penalty, one of three that really killed the 49ers in this undisciplined game. So they got to clean that up, but then they have to also root themselves in the progress that they've made. And you see it in the wide nine from Elliott. You see it from Leonard Floyd. You see it from Yetur Gross-Matos, who delivered more pressure yesterday. They have to root themselves in that progress to look forward to 2025, where they're going to return all of these defensive linemen. There's a whole heck of a lot of green shading here in the defensive line. That's going to be the basis for constructing the defense over the offseason, because you've got to make a lot of re-signings at linebacker and in the defensive backfield. But if the line is more or less set, and I think there's a lot of good stuff that we've been seeing for the defensive line, it sets the table for the 49ers to do productive work building out the rest of the linebacker and DB units this offseason. So that's what's on the table for the defense. All right, I'm going to rapid fire a couple questions, then I'm going to get going. I actually want to see some questions, guys. I don't have all day here. All I see is people arguing in the comments section. All right, Mike restores order. Do the 49ers win a game the rest of this season? Well, they're not going to be favored against Detroit, but Detroit has a bad defense with all these injuries right now. 49ers are going to have a beleaguered line, and I wrote all about yesterday in the San Francisco Standard. I wrote all about the 49ers needing to improve the offensive line and how it probably won't be pretty for the rest of this season. But that being said, it hadn't been pretty, and it's not pretty right now for the Lions defense. So I think the 49ers might be able to overcome some of the issues up front against Detroit, but it's going to be really, really hard to overcome all of them given the poor state of the line. I could tell you guys what the spread is going to be next week against the Lions as we try to answer Mike's question. Week 17, Detroit favored by 3.5. See, it's not a huge spread, so the game could still go either way. This is the NFL. It's just kind of how the league works. But I don't think the 49ers will be favored against the Arizona Cardinals either, although we saw Arizona lose to Carolina yesterday, so that is a very winnable game. We'll just see how the 49ers come out. The health situation is going to be something that's impactful of their chances in the final two games, and Kyle Shanahan is going to be speaking to the media in a couple hours, so I'll have the update for you when that happens. This is a good way to finish. I can't really read your screen name. Innovatrium. That's cool. All right. But anyway, this is thank you very much. Merry Christmas to you as well. This is sports. Sometimes your year, sometimes it isn't. Thanks for Lombardi for always reporting objectively. Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. And yes, I am always going to report objectively, especially on the most important position. That's Brock Purdy. He played well for the 49ers. And there are people that don't like when you say that. I don't care if you don't like when I say that, because I'm going to say the truth about the 49ers. And Purdy was very good behind a depleted offensive line yesterday. He's been good this whole season for the 49ers. And it is not that complicated. It should not be hard to disassociate a quarterback's play from struggles around him. You can't completely do it, but you can do it within reason. And you could see that Purdy definitely is not one of the 49ers' problems. They've got a lot of problems, but the quarterback who they're about to pay is not one of them. And I think that the interception yesterday, analysis of that play, has really exposed those who know what they're talking about and separated them from people who do not know what they're talking about when it comes to quarterback analysis. That one wasn't on Purdy. Neither was the game. There were a whole lot of other disciplinary issues for the 49ers and a whole lot of other problems that they were not able to overcome yesterday. They've got to be better as a team, and that's what they're going to try to do heading into 2025. All right, everybody, go check out the San Francisco Standard. Sign up for the membership. Link is in the description. Thanks for watching. Merry Christmas. We are going to be right next to the boards at an NHL hockey game tonight. We're going to be right off the ice, so maybe get some footage of that for you. I think it's Nashville against the Carolina Hurricanes. So should be fun. Everybody, take care.